Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and I'm joined today by Marlene Wint, author of The Tribalization of Europe, A Defense of Our Liberal Values, which was published in June by Polity. This is a short and timely polemic. Arguably, the European project is facing the greatest existential threat in its history. One of the big four member states has left the European Union. The main opposition parties in France and Italy flirt with leaving. Two of its newer Eastern members are drifting away from liberal democracy. And for the first time, an American president openly calls for the destruction of the Union. Among these threats, Professor Wint has identified a common theme, tribalization, and a common remedy, an end to defeatism among liberal Democrats and what President Trump might call globalist cucks. Educated at Aarhus University and at the European University Institute in Florence, Marlene is a professor of political science and the director of the Center for European Politics at Copenhagen University. She also teaches at the University of Oslo. She's an expert on the interplay of politics and law in the European Union, on democratic theory, the role of the judiciary, populism, Euroscepticism, and Brexit. Before this book, she authored and co-authored six others. On top of all that, she is currently advising the European Commission on the rule of law, and on the basis of this book, is providing counsel to the Office of Commission President von der Leyen. Marlene, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Now, there's an obvious political and economic backdrop to this book, but what was the immediate catalyst that made you write it?
Well, I guess the book is a bit different from my other contributions, academic contributions, in the sense that this book is really quite personal, and it's very opinionated. Normally, as an academic, you don't write this kind of books. Or when you do, you need to be really senior, and you need to but it's also a special style. I think you find this type of books a lot in the U.S., for instance, but not so much maybe in Europe. But what made me write it, I think it's, I've always been engaged in the public debate and very active, writing columns for newspapers, several newspapers for 25 years. So I think that it's it was a accumulated sort of, it came from my different takes on the European development, for commenting on it, Brexit, being a spectator to what was going on also in Catalonia, in Central and Eastern Europe, and of course by following very closely how the European Union has developed over the past 10-15 years. So I think I just reached that stage in my academic career where I thought, now I can write this book. Now I dare to write this book. Now I sort of feel that it's really needed. in a sense. So that's I think the explanation. It's very hard for me to it just had to come out somehow. So for me it was a very important and urgent book, and I have a lot of personal anger in it and feelings, and that's of course also not so normal, being a professor and normally at least pretending to be objective and being kind of looking at everything from the one side and from the other side and try to be nuanced and so on. I know a lot of my other colleagues, for instance, in the UK have also contributed to the debate on Brexit. And I mean, it's not always easy to be an academic and then also to write these kind of opinionated pieces. But for me, this was really the time. And I also sometimes feel that academics are a bit, you know, too timid to step out there and actually try to contribute with their own perspectives and own views. And what are we paid for in the end? I mean, if we don't contribute with anything but, boring articles in scientific journals, nobody reads them. Then, yeah, I mean, that's kind of my way of being a professor also, that I always contributed to the public debate. I step up. I've actually received a lot of bashing from politicians for politicizing and what else they come up with, mainly for defending Europe. I mean, in Denmark, in that sense, Denmark, where I come from, and I live in Copenhagen, it's in many ways quite similar to the UK, the debate we have had on Europe. There's a lot of politicians who are very, very busy trying to talk down the European project, and they think they can gain voters from doing so, and the tabloids do the same, and so if you try to just sometimes step into this quagmire and argue that, well, where would we be without the European Union? I mean, we would be so incredibly poor. We would, I mean, have to run and beg everyone to buy our goods. And I mean, sometimes you just, you cannot just expect people to vote yes to all kinds of referendums. You know, Denmark is a country where we've actually had quite many referendums on Europe, and it's not always gone very well. So I've kind of been active in this whole debate for the past 20 years, and this book was just kind of I reached this plateau where I just had to write it, and I really feel for what I've written in it. So it's, for me, it's opinionated, but it's also building on my research. I mean, studying democracy, democratic theory, the role of courts. I mean, look what's happening right now in the UK with Boris Johnson all of a sudden not wanting to live up to his promises with the withdrawal agreement. I mean, this is really deep down, having studied also what is sovereignty, how do we talk about democracy differently in different countries? So trying to sort of tap everything together in this kind of very, I would call it direct and forceful argument that I'm making. Well, that's my own opinion, but maybe you think differently.
Well, no,
but that's sort of that very long answer to your question.
Well, no, it reads like a polemic. It reads like
yes,
I mean,
yes.
I read it in one sitting. How long did it take you to write?
Wow, I'm happy to hear that, because that was actually also the intention.
Yeah. Did it, I mean, how long did it take you to write, if it took me one sitting to read?
Well, it actually, yeah, I've always been known for writing, sorry to be so bragging, but writing very clear language in my columns that the newspaper journals in Denmark, they are very eager to have me as an op-ed. I've written for almost all the big newspapers. And they are constantly fighting to have me as a writer. I think it's because I really like to write in a polemic language, and I'm very clear, and I'm also not afraid of saying what I think. I hope that the book, you said you read it very quickly, but it was actually not that that quickly written, because I really work a lot with my language when I write. And for me, it has to be very, very clear and very simple. And that actually takes more time than write something that is incredibly, you know, impossible to understand or mm-hmm. or tricky. Well, it took me a summer and maybe a bit more. I wrote it. I wrote it in a summer holiday. But maybe, you know, in the end, it probably took some more months because I also had to edit and mm-hmm. yeah. So it was not as quickly written as I hope it is to read, because I really, really, you know, it's also been. You know, I've been giving a lot of interviews about the book, and a lot of so-called ordinary people have bought it and read it. It's also coming. It's also been published in Danish, and I really like that. I mean, that it's something that speaks to. I just read Timothy Garton Ash had an op-ed today in the Financial Times where he wrote. We need to learn to be more passionate in the way we communicate, you know, the global order and the necessity of working together and upholding the law. Why are those who write about that and think about these things always writing in this incredibly boring academic style? And since this is really the message that I'm trying to convey, that. I mean, what is the alternative? To be eaten up by China? I mean, or Russia? I mean, they are cheering every time we fight each other. So it was really my urge to try to deliver this message in a more passionate way than you normally do when you write boring academic books about the rule of law and you know, I've done that, you know, been there. So it's just it's very important that you if you really have this kind of view on things, you also need to be able to communicate it in a relatively clear and simplistic and even polemic, because in my opinion polemics actually make people think and it provokes people, I know, but it also makes you think to a different degree, I think, than when you try to, you know, be on the one hand. On the other hand, you also have to understand the populist. It's very important. They have their reasons to be populist. Well, okay, fine. But I don't give a shit about that. I mean, for me, it's just incredibly dangerous what we are doing with all this. As that's kind of one of the most important points in my book about this understanding the people. Of course we have to understand the people, but we also have to sort of be able to say what is bullshit and what isn't. I mean, the people will be the ones suffering from Brexit, the ordinary man in the street losing his job. And if we don't dare to say that, and if we don't dare to say that, if we don't fight for our basic rules and values, then I mean there'll be someone else there to shut down the internet, to shut our you know newspapers, to force us out of communicating directly and make us afraid of speaking up. I mean, there are lots of those out there, and one of the final points I write in my book is really that Europe is you know a shrinking continent, and we are only 8% Europeans left in the world. I mean, nobody has promised us that it's our values and our idea of the good life, democracy, that will end up surviving. And in my analysis, at least, we haven't even realized that yet. We are just complacent, you know, letting things happen. We don't even care to defend our own small haven of or small paradise even. I mean, look around the world and what people are having to face, not just in China and Africa and other places, also in the United States, where you can discuss whether you even have a democratic public debate anymore with instead of just opposing camps that are constantly fighting each other and not talking to each other. So, so that's kind of my urge to write it was really based on this, that we have to wake up. We have to realize that instead of fighting each other and building new walls and leaving the European Union, but also inside the European Union, that we are so busy finding differences constantly and blaming each other for not doing enough. You know, the Commission didn't do enough during the COVID crisis. Well, I mean, why are we so busy blaming? I mean, it's in the end, it's us who are not doing enough. It's the member states who do not want to distribute refugees from the terrible camp in Greece. It's the member states who do not want to deal with a global health crisis together. It's the member states who are, you know, trying to undermine the other countries and their ability to save the European economy and so on. I mean, it's all down to the member states and the politicians we have voted for. Mm-hmm. So, but we are very busy constantly blaming someone else for the failures. So that's also kind of you know, I'm not soft with my own country either in this book. I mean, originally I because I've been so much in the fire in Denmark, and in particular right-wing politicians have tried to get me fired and so on. I mean, so I thought I don't want to really comment on Denmark as such, but you know, we also had this very strange, actually quite comparable to the UK, with constantly questioning whether should we even be in a community where, or a union where we have supranational courts that can set aside what the sovereignty, you know, the sovereign parliament has decided, you know, starting to undermine the European Convention of Human Rights. You know, we had a center-right government that simply took that on board and started to question whether whether Europe should defend these basic rights that we have had since the Second World War, whether we should withdraw from it. I mean, my point is sort of to say this kind of undermining of the international, you know, liberal order, it starts with us, you know. It's our own politicians who start questioning. And my point is, as I write in my book, that who is cheering? I mean, Putin is standing, you know, cheering every time, you know, the mess that happens right now, sorry to say, in your country, in the UK. And also every time, you know, Orban says he does not want to sign up to the rule of law, or Denmark says, why do we even have to submit to a supranational court, whether it's the court in Luxembourg or in Strasbourg, you know, it's just as bad. So we are constantly ourselves contributing to this questioning whether it's legitimate, whether it's fine, whether it's okay, is it even democratic? You know, we have politicians in my country who say that it's not democratic to have to submit to international law, because then the sovereign parliament cannot decide for itself. Well, I mean, that's what the whole European past Second World War order was about. It was about you know, submitting to common rules so that we don't fight each other, so that we have one legal sphere that we can trade within instead of having 27 different legal spheres where you have to constantly find out what are the rules in Greece, what are the rules in Italy, what are the rules in Bulgaria. I mean, the whole point was to create common standards, both for, you know, the good society, for human rights, but also for how we trade with each other. So it's I think we have a lot, we have to a very high degree ourselves to blame for the mess we're in right now. I know the book is incredibly pessimistic. It's and I really didn't want to write something that was that pessimistic, but it's, I think you have to go there in order to sort of, yeah, to make your point and to make people realize that that we simply need to talk about this differently and act differently and move in a different direction. Otherwise, it will end up, you know, yeah, we will end up destroying ourselves in a way.
Yeah, you said a few times there that we are to blame, and the implication was that that's mostly member states and their governments. But do you think, as you haven't used the word, but do you think that people, the electorate themselves, have become in a way decadent or complacent? They've in the United Kingdom, in the United States, throughout the European Union, they have accepted decades of wealth and peace and taken it for granted. And as you actually say in the book, as a political platform, it's much easier for a politician to talk to voters about blood, land and history than it is to talk about vague concepts like cooperation or the long-term benefits of competition and trade. So I guess what I'm getting at is that this isn't just for governments, this is for people to wake up and basically defend something with a 60-year history before it's disappeared without them actually doing anything.
Yeah, and that's dangerous because you very easily, in particular being an academic, you very easily get into big trouble when you say that people could also themselves be a little bit less decadent and a little bit less complacent. I mean, why don't you read a book? Why don't you go to the library? Why don't you, before you go voting, find out what the EU is? I mean, I remember in the UK, the most sought for word after Brexit was, what is the EU, right? After the vote. So that's just a very good example of, and I'm not blaming the British voters, alone. I think it's the same we see in many countries. I mean, right now you see people in Belarus standing up, and I'm very, very impressed with this because they have not had a free press for many years. So it's probably the internet that has made this happen. Mm. But why is this not happening in Hungary? You know, why are people not going into the streets? I have a lot of very good contacts in Hungary, but it's mostly those in academia and critical journalists and so on who are mad about or upset about upset with the autocracy of Viktor Orban. I mean, ordinary people are just, you know, you get a little bit higher welfare benefits at the next election. And it's the same in Poland. You also had an increase in child benefit, and you've got an increase in pensions. And then people vote for these autocrats. I mean, so yes, I'm trying also to convey the message that, I mean, if we don't have democracy and access to express our views anymore, then these people who are complacent will also suffer, because in the long run, at least, maybe they can manage right now because they, you know, they get this little higher benefits. And in Poland, Hungary, it's even incredibly anti-feminist in the sense that they pay women to stay home and to have babies, right? Mm-hmm. So the more babies you have, the more you get from the state. And it's just incredibly sexist and, I think, undermining the freedom to think for yourself and to engage in society and to even exchange views and be in opposition to what's going on. So it's an attempt, I think, by some very cynical leaders that I also talk about in my book. I talk about this cynicism by leaders who are not even, they are not in many instances not even believing in what they themselves tell people. Mm. So in Hungary, for instance, you have a Viktor Orban who constantly talks about Muslim immigrants. I mean, there are no Muslim immigrants in Hungary, right? But he knows exactly what buttons to push to make people upset and to create fear, you know, fear mongering. My claim is that, well, it's very convenient because then nobody will dig into his corruption. And I think we see a bit the same in the British government, Boris Johnson. I mean, does he believe in Brexit himself? I don't even think so, you know. But it's a way of keeping himself in office. And you know, when the just before the referendum in the UK, Boris Johnson was a journalist, as you know, and, mm-hmm. and he had these two op-eds: should he vote in favor, should he recommend Brexit, or should he recommend the opposite, right? Remain. And this cynicism is something that I see across Europe, because you can easily ask me why are these cases you are talking about in your book, do they even match each other, or are they not too different? But I think what really makes them similar in many ways is the fact that you have these kind of incredibly cynic leaders who are rounded up by or supported by some just a cynic, or maybe even more cynic, spin doctors and advisors who are running this show, and not much of what comes out from these professional communications, political communications machines are about what these politicians really believe. That's my claim. I know it's my claim, but I think we see this cynicism in a lot of places right now, and so it's actually manipulating ordinary citizens to believe that they believe in what they're saying, but in reality, it's more about them staying in office or getting their getting money from the EU to their own projects, their own pet projects, and trying to avoid that anyone gets to know about it. So there is this kind of cynicism right now in modern politics. You see the same in the US. I mean, and that can lead to, in my opinion, a very, very dangerous place where these politicians, they would actually sacrifice Europe and our democracies for their own small personal gains. Mm. And that is something that is really scaring me. And it's scaring me that nobody talks about it and nobody dares to speak up about it. Another point that I have in my book that you probably also noticed is this idea that a lot of, in my opinion, at least journalists and commentators and so on, they were so taken aback by Trump that he was elected to the White House and that Brexit could even happen. That now everyone is supposed to embrace the people. So we are back to your original question, right? So it's not very politically correct to say, well, maybe the people are wrong, or maybe we told them something that was wrong. Maybe we contributed, to because we were so, shocked by what could happen and how angry people could be, that we, instead of saying, okay, you voted for this, fine, but we don't agree. This is not good. This is terrible. So instead, I think I have at least felt on my own body that a lot of neoconservatives, nationalists, commentators are, oh, you're so elitist, you should not tell people what they should think, you should rather embrace them and you should follow what they say and what they feel, and you don't understand them, and so on. And of course they may have a point. I'm not saying that I know everything and that those who fight for Europe or just rule of law, I mean, in any way better people or have more insight. I'm just saying that I'm pretty surprised by how few people are left insisting that, I mean, we have this very unique liberal order in Europe. We've had it since the Second World War. We created it ourselves. It's been close to falling apart several times. We had the fall of the Berlin Wall. We had new countries that we embraced and took in. We are living in a world with autocrats, with people being poisoned and killed by criticizing big leaders like Xi Jinping and Putin. We are living in this small, unique enclave in Europe, and still, there. I think that a lot of intellectuals and commentators are more busy telling other intellectuals that they should back off and that they should, embrace those feelings.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think there is a good point that links to you have two chapters, one where you say one that's something like who are the people, so a definition of who the people are, and then you also have this chapter where you discuss counter-majoritarian institutions.
Yes.
And I think
yes.
for you look at the, I mean, this has happened in several countries. You look at the two countries where there have been these two major shocking events in 2016, one being Brexit, the other being Trump. You could argue that both of those were delivered by a minority of the population, and they were delivered by unusual institutions, essentially first-past-the-post institutions.
Exactly.
And I think for many people, especially those coming from countries like the UK or the US who live in these, you know, the first past the post or electoral college systems, we think of democracy as majority rule.
Yeah.
But it's a very good point you make about the importance since the Second World War of counter-majoritarian institutions that were done at the national level, but would also the creation of the Convention on Human Rights and so on, and ultimately the EU itself. So could you expand on that?
Yeah, that's really my heart child, I would say, because I've been occupied with this debate for past 10 years or maybe more, because I'm very interested in the role of democracy, but also in the role of counter-majoritarian institutions and in the a peculiar insistence among not just the UK and maybe the US, but certainly because the US do have counter-majoritarian institutions. I mean, they are the ones who pushed this on Europe and said you have to create strong courts, right? But actually, the Scandinavian countries are also very, very focused on having parliaments that are not supposed to submit to courts, neither in their own sort of constituency or community, in their own country, but not at the European level, and that is something that I find both very disturbing, but also incredibly important to understand the lacking emotional support for the European Union in many ways, because for a German after the Second World War and for almost all other countries that became democracies, Now we can discuss what's happening in Poland and Hungary on this point, but the common thing, the common kind of movement in Europe since the Second World War has been this idea that it's not enough to have a parliament that is sovereign. You need, in order to protect minorities and basic rights, you need to have counter-majoritarian institutions. And you can actually argue that if you do not have that, if you do not have strong courts that can exercise judicial review, then you are not a real democracy. Mm-hmm. And I come from a country where this is, you can even, politicians in the parliament who never heard about that you could have a democracy that is different than, majoritarian democracy. So it's very interesting that those countries that are most skeptical towards Europe are the ones that actually never acquired this kind of constitutional moment, this kind of idea that you need to have balances of powers and not just division of powers. So you have a division of powers in the sense that, of course, you have in Western Europe, you still have, of course, independent judges, even though they are called enemies of the people sometimes in the UK. But you don't have a balances of power. So you don't think judicial review is really legitimate. You think it's some white-headed guys sitting on the bench and telling the so-called ordinary people, because the parliament represents the ordinary people, what to do. And judicial review in a constitutional democracy is really about that. I mean, ask any German or French or anyone in Europe, also Italian, how they would define democracy. They would say balance of powers and not majoritarian democracy and the parliament as the only kind of legitimate body. But in our part of the world, we never understood this. And you have, of course, to remember that the reason why the Americans actually acquired this of the Germans after the Second World War, when they came with the Marshall Help, was that what happened in Germany just before the Nazis took over was that there was a majority in parliament and very weak courts that could not put down their foot to the extinction of Jews and minorities, sexual minorities of any kind. So there was a situation actually just before these laws were introduced in the German Reichstag that are very similar to the situation we have in. At least the kind of democracy we have in Northern Europe. So this idea that courts should be weak, should not be allowed to overrule the parliament, that was exactly what you wanted to get away from in Germany and also in the rest of Europe, because the rest of Europe and the European Union is built on this kind of philosophy that in order to protect rule of law and minorities in the future, you need strong courts that constantly supervise parliaments for not going in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. Parliaments can be incredibly dangerous. You know that also, for instance, in Germany, after the Second World War, referenda are forbidden because it's dangerous to have this kind of populist search that is really not necessarily, as you mentioned before, representing the people. They are represented maybe half the people if you vote on something. And that is not, at least that's how the Germans look at it, it's not a true democracy. So representative democracy, but also strong courts is really what became also with the European Court of Justice and with the Human Rights Court in Strasbourg, became the symbol of the rule of law in Europe. And it's just so incredibly hard to understand even today for Brits and for Danes that it's really amazing how bad we have been at conveying the benefits of living in a system where you actually have a true balance of powers and strong courts that can protect minorities and protect the rule of law. And that is exactly what we're seeing right now in Hungary and Poland. Mm-hmm. They are moving in a majoritarian direction. So they are sort of, you know, putting their own friends on the bench in the courts. And I mean, there are no impartial courts anymore in these countries, at least not in Hungary. In Poland, they are trying constantly to undermine independent courts. There's been so many infringement cases against these so-called judicial reforms in Poland. So it's in my opinion a very common trait from autocracies or wannabe autocracies that they move in this direction, challenging, criticizing the courts, the judges, criticizing independent media, limiting who is right to speak and who is not allowed to have an opinion. This kind pinpointing what is the right opinion from which academics, and also who's allowed to engage in the debate and constantly criticize and prosecute even those who are in disagreement with you. So it's so far in my opinion from a true liberal democracy what we are seeing right now. I am of course not seeing that the UK and Denmark are becoming autocracies, and Denmark is certainly, you know, we are not as far out as, sorry to say, right now the UK is in terms of undermining the rule of law. But you do see traits of this, and the big problem is, of course, also that nobody is saying anything. Nobody is putting down their foot to what's going on in Europe. And there, my point is, of course, that if we don't even do it ourselves, also our own politicians and European politicians, then how can we run around and tell Erdogan and Putin and Xi Jinping that they are not treating people properly and that they are undermining the rule of law and so on if we are not even able to do this in Europe? That's what's really worrying me.
You say it will be a serious threat to the EU's credibility if they don't deal properly with Orbán and Kaczynski. I mean, the history of enforcement of mostly through Article 7 of the treaty has not been a happy one. There is this possibility now of the linkage of the new next generation EU recovery fund to rule of law provisions. And people seem split as to how seriously to take that provision. Where do you fall in that debate?
Well, I certainly hope that it will eventually happen, but I'm not very optimistic, I would say. I think that Orbán somehow has a grip on the European People's Party in the European Parliament, and they are, you know, embracing both von der Leyen and Merkel. So as long as they have not made up their mind about what to do with autocracies in Europe and how to deal with countries that are undermining the rule of law so seriously as is happening and has been happening for 10 years now in Hungary and for 4 or 5 years in Poland, but also in many other countries. You have corruption in so many places. I mean, as long as you don't have politicians who dare to step up and seriously deal with this question, because they are afraid of losing majority in parliament, or they are afraid of Orbán was the one supporting von der Leyen, She feels perhaps that she owes him something, and so I really think that it's going to be very difficult, and maybe it's only the European Parliament, you know, often called the Mickey Mouse Parliament or the not a real parliament, or, you know, there's lots of EU critics out there who are busy telling everyone that the parliament is ridiculous. Nigel Farage, for instance. But maybe they will, in the end, be the ones that most seriously say, okay, we will not vote for this budget if there is no rule of law conditionality. And I really think that it's important that we talk very openly about this. I know it's some people say, you shouldn't be so harsh on Central and Eastern Europe because they're, you know, new democracies, they have to find their feet and so on. But I mean, I just can't see that we can compromise on those absolutely basic values that you shouldn't be corrupt. And certainly not with our taxpayers' money, you know, coming from all over Europe, which is actually what is happening, you know, in many of these, at least some of these countries. But also we shouldn't compromise on Article 2, which is the basic, you know, the most minimal, you know, division of powers, impartial judges, free press, ability for any civil society group to act without being on a blacklist or being refused, you know, housing or money or funding or, you know. So these things are, in my opinion, so basic to the European, to what we have in common in Europe, that if we compromise on that, I can't see what's left, to be honest. I simply can't see what is left. I can't see why I should support this project even.
Well, I think that's an important point, actually. And do you think that if this fails, you know, linking the next generation funding to rule of law, and especially if Orbán wins again in 2022, do you think it's then time to think about something really radical, like, for example, in 2012, when David Cameron, the then British Prime Minister, refused to sign the Fiscal Compact Treaty, and within 3 months, every other member state, or nearly every other member state, had signed their own treaty.
Yeah.
So essentially you could sort of break away from the EU, you could create a European confederation within the EU, and then you leave these countries in the rump EU. Is it time to start thinking about something like that?
It's a very interesting perspective, because that's actually what my young students tell me, you know, when we discuss this, and things, new innovative thinking often comes from students. And there was simply, I remember one putting up his hand and saying, why don't we just create a Europe for democracies? You know, why are we still dealing with these persons? I mean, they promised when they entered the EU that they would sign up to all these values. They promised, you know, the Copenhagen criteria and so on. So why are we dealing with this? I mean, why are we sending money to these countries? Even in the new budget, you can see how much money goes to Hungary and Czech Republic. They were last year, I don't know if you saw that article by New York Times on the front page, you know, the money farmers. On the 9th of November, if any of the listeners wants to Google it, it's really, really the most embarrassing article I've seen, on the front page of any big international newspaper, saying, you know, why are we putting money into these people's pockets? I mean, we are contributing by the system we have set up with, the way we are spending money in Europe with agricultural funds and structural funds. And now we have the recovery fund as well. Mm. And we haven't changed the rules for what conditions should there be? And partly, of course, because that we have so much faith in each other in Europe. We have had that since the beginning, that if you are fraudulent and you are not spending money correctly, it's the national authorities that should deal with this. But what happens if you have national authorities that are also paid and bought up by the oligarchs and by the leaders of an autocracy? I mean, you cannot trust independent bodies and accountants to research this, and the media is also prohibited, because if you do research into corruption, you get killed, right? So I think that's a very good it's of course a little bit drastic to say that we should create a new Europe, but to be honest, I don't think the young generation will accept this the structure it has right now. I think there are so many problems, and these values are so important. I can feel that when I talk to the younger generations, and of course my students, that this is something that really occupies them. Illiberal democracies, the discussion about what to do with them, the discussion about where is Europe heading? I mean, will we even have human rights and basic rights, rule of law in 20, 25 years if we just do nothing? Because there's so many others out there in the world that would love to buy up our assets in Europe and would like to, you know, take over even these countries. You know, lots of them have investments from China and Russia. It's scary to see how we have been incredibly naive in Europe by not dealing with this. Also up front, to just take the discussion, do we really want this? Do we want countries to just let China and Russia buy up all our assets and to also influence the media and all these questions about cyber attacks coming, you know, disrupting elections in democracies, making people more and more doubtful about whether they can trust the politicians. It's all part, I think, of I don't want to sound as a conspiracy theorist, but I know it sounds a little bit like that, but I think that these dangers are so and challenges are so enormous that that they should be dealt with.
Well, I mean, that brings me to my last question, which sort of turns the book on its head a bit, which is to ask, do you think there's a risk that at least some advocates of European integration can fall into the same trap, which is that they start to see the process and the institutions as the goal? So the European flag, the European anthem, European Commission, European Parliament, rather than focusing on the benefits that the EU or the European Economic Area can bring, jobs, free movement, improved services, reduced risk of conflict. In fact, we too become a tribe and see the skeptics as the other.
Mm. I think that was probably a danger in the 80s, 90s. I think that there was a certain sentiment in Brussels. I was the stagiaire myself in the 90s in the Commission and actually working in communication. And I thought it was too much with all these, you know, flags and all these kind of very superficial messages coming out at times from the Commission. But I think that is really something of the past. I think that it's, people have become far too critical and far too demanding, and the media has also, I mean, we have so much, I mean, we have a lot of crappy media, but we certainly also have some very good Politico and others, good media in Brussels, that, you know, you cannot get away with arguing for Europe just for Europe's own sake. If it doesn't deliver, then people will say, well, I'm sorry, this is just not good enough. So I think it's not possible today to and of course, you can easily find people who would defend this kind of stuff. I'm not at all in doubt about that. But I think the overall, and my impression from I lived in Brussels last year, or in 2018 to 2019, from talking to people, from sensing the discussions, from really getting it under my skin in a sense, people are so incredibly occupied with delivering. With delivering on borders, on migration, on, I mean, look at the recovery fund. I mean, now I've said a lot of bad things about Europe, but mostly I've said a lot of bad things about the member states. But I think that was actually a very, very good example of a Europe that can deliver in terms of saying, okay, let's realize what's really at stake here. We are losing some generations in Southern Europe. and who has benefited mainly from the internal market and the euro. That's been Germany and us from Northern Europe. I mean, we're not part of the euro, but we have benefited enormously. And we are export-driven economies. We are the ones who have, you know, been able to sell all of our goods. At the same time, in particular, Germany has not, risen its minimum wages. So people have not been able to import as much or to buy as much goods from Italy and Spain and so on. So, I mean, we owe them big time. And I think it was... that's my analysis, but I think that it was really a revelation and an interesting U-turn that Germany did during the COVID crisis. That all of a sudden they realized that what will happen to their economy if Italy has to leave the euro or even leave the EU, and you know. So the UK was not just the first, but then, you know, COVID crisis came and after financial crisis, and then we end up with maybe a Europe that breaks up. I mean, in particular, when looking at who actually have had the largest benefits of the internal market. So invest more, spend more, get the wheels running again. That is what it's about. And I think that the politicians have actually delivered on that. But I just don't think they have delivered on the rule of law and linking all this money and all these new investments to also a respect for our basic rights in Europe. And I think that is on time.
Okay. Well, to remind our listeners, we've been discussing Marlene Wynne's Tribalization of Europe, published in June by Polity. Marlene, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Tim, for having me. It was a pleasure.